down there and its movement, and the checkered fields behind fading into pale, dun, formless hills. Was it merely Jack ashore? Yet he was such a pleasant, ingenuous companion. He smiled at the recollection. Still and all, what weight can be attached to? We had dined extremely well. 4 bottles, or possibly 5. I must not expose myself to an affront. He turned it over and over, arguing against his hopes, but coming at last to the conclusion that if he could make his coat passably respectable, and the dust does seem to be getting it off, or at least disguising it, he said, he would call on Mr. Florey at the hospital and talk to him in a general way about the naval surgeon's calling. He brushed the ants from his wig and settled it on his head. Then, as he walked down towards the edge of the road, the magenta spikes of gladioli and the taller grass, the recollection of that unlucky name stopped him in his stride. How had he come to forget it so entirely in his sleep? How was it possible that the name James Dillon had not presented itself at once to his waking mind? Yet it is true there are hundreds of Dillons, he reflected, and a great many of them are called James, of course. Christe, hummed James Dillon under his breath, shaving the red-gold bristles off his face in what light could make its way through the scuttle of the Burford's number 12 gunport. Christe eleison, Kyrie. This was less piety in James Dillon than a way of hoping he should not cut himself, for like so many papists, he was somewhat given to blasphemy. The difficulty of the planes under his nose silenced him, however, and when his upper lip was clean, he couldn't hit the note again. In any case, his mind was too busy to be seeking after an elusive Nahum, for he was about to report to a new captain, a man upon whom his comfort and ease of mind was to depend, to say nothing of his reputation, career, and prospects of advancement. Stroking his shining smoothness, he hurried out into the wardroom and shouted for a marine. "Just brush the back of my coat, will you, Curtis? My chest is quite ready, and the bread sack of books is to go with it," he said. "Is the captain on deck?" "Oh, no, sir, no," said the marine. "Breakfast only just carrying in this moment. 2 hard-boiled eggs and 1 soft. The soft-boiled egg was for Miss Smith, to recruit her from her labours of the night, as both the marine and Mr. Dillon knew very well. But the marine's knowing look met with a total lack of response. James Dillon's mouth tightened, and for a fleeting moment, as he ran up the ladder to the sudden brilliance of the quarter-deck, it wore a positively angry expression. Here he greeted the officer of the watch and the Burford's first lieutenant. Good morning to you. My word, you're very fine," they said. "There she lies, just beyond the Genera." His eyes ranged over the busy harbour. The light was so nearly horizontal that all the masts and yards assumed a strange importance, and the little skipping waves sent back a blinding sparkle. "No, no," they said, "over by the sheer hulk. The felucca has just masked her. There. Now do you see her?" He did indeed. He had been looking far too high, and his gaze had swept right over the Sophie as she lay there, not much above a cable's length away, very low in the water. He leant both hands on the rail and looked at her with unwinking concentration. After a while, he borrowed the telescope from the officer of the watch and did the same again, with a most searching, minute scrutiny. He could see the gleam of an epaulette, whose wearer could only be her captain, and her people were as active as bees just about to swarm. He had been prepared for a little brig, but not for quite such a dwarfish vessel as this. Most 14-gun sloops were between 200 and 250 tons in burthen. The Sophie could scarcely be more than 150. "I like her little quarter-deck," said the officer of the watch. She was the Spanish Francejo, was she not? And as for being rather low, why, anything you look at close to from a 74 looks rather low. There were three things that everybody knew about the Sophie. One was that, unlike almost all other brigs, she had a quarterdeck. Another was that she had been Spanish. And a third was that she possessed an elm tree pump on her forecastle, that is to say, a bored-out trunk that communicated directly with the sea and that was used for washing her deck. An insignificant piece of equipment, really, but one so far above her station that no mariner who saw it or heard of this pump ever forgot it. "Maybe your quarters will be a little cramped," said the First Lieutenant, "but you'll have a quiet, restful time of it, I'm sure, convoying the trade up and down the Mediterranean." "Well," said James Dillon, unable to find a brisk retort to this possibly well-intentioned kindness. "Well," he said with a philosophical shrug, "you let me have a boat, sir. I should like to report as early as I can." "A boat? God rot my soul," cried the First Lieutenant. "I shall be asked for the barge next thing I know. Passengers in the Burford wait for a bumboat from shore, Mr. Dillon, or else they swim." He stared at James with cold severity, until the quartermaster's chuckle betrayed him, for Mr. Coffin was a great wag, a wag even before breakfast. "Dillon, sir, reporting for duty, if you please," said James, taking off his hat in the brilliant sun and displaying a blaze of dark red hair. "Welcome aboard, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, touching his own, holding out his hand and looking at him with so intense a desire to know what kind of man he was that his face had an almost forbidding acuity. "You would be welcome in any case, but even more so this morning. We have a busy day ahead of us. Masthead there, any sign of life on the wharf?" "Nothing yet, sir." "The wind is exactly where I want it," said Jack, looking for the hundredth time at the rare white clouds sailing evenly across the perfect sky. "But with this rising glass, there's no trusting to it." "Your coffee's up, sir," said the steward. "Thank you, Killick. What is it, Mr. Lamb?" "I haven't no ring bolts anywheres near big enough, sir," said the carpenter. "But there's a heap on them at the yard, I know. May I send over?" "No, Mr. Lamb. Don't you go near that yard to save your life. Double the clench bolts you have. Set up the forge and fashion a serviceable ring. It won't take you half an hour. Now, Mr. Dillon, when you've settled in comfortably below, perhaps you'll come and drink a cup of coffee with me and I'll tell you what I have in mind." James hurried below to the three-cornered booth that he was to live in, whipped out of his reporting uniform into trousers and an old blue coat, reappearing while Jack was still blowing thoughtfully upon his cup. "Sit down, Mr. Dillon, sit down," he cried. "Push those papers aside. It's a sad brew, I'm afraid, but at least it's wet, that I can promise you. Sugar?" "If you please, sir," said young Ricketts. "The Genereux cutters alongside with the men who were drafted off for harbour duty." "All of them?" "All except two, sir, that have been changed." Still holding his coffee cup, Jack writhed from behind the table and with a twist of his body out through the door. Hooked onto the larboard main chains, there was the Genereux boat, filled with seamen, looking up, laughing and exchanging witticisms, or mere hoots and whistles with their former shipmates. The Genereux midshipman saluted and said, "Captain Hart's compliments, sir, and he finds the draft can be spared." "God bless your heart, dear Molly," said Jack. And aloud, "My compliments and best thanks to Captain Hart. Be so good as to send them aboard." They were not much to look at, he reflected, as the whip from the yardarm hoisted up their meagre belongings. Three or four were decidedly simple, and two others had that indefinable air of men of some parts whose cleverness sets them apart from their fellows, but not nearly so far as they imagine. Two of the boobies were quite horribly dirty, and one had managed to exchange his slops for a red garment with remains of tinsel upon it. Still, they all possess two hands. They could all clap onto a rope. And it would be strange if the bosun and his mates couldn't induce them to heave. "Deck!" hailed the midshipman aloft. "Deck! There is someone moving about on the wharf." "Very good, Mr. Babington. You may come down and have your breakfast now." "Six hands I thought lost for good," he said to James Dillon with intense satisfaction, turning back to the cabin. "They may not be much to look at. Indeed, I think we must rig a tub if we are not to have an itchy ship. But they will help us weigh, and I hope to weigh by 9:30 at the latest." Jack wrapped the brass-bound wood of the locker and went on. "We will ship 2 long 12s as chase pieces if I can get them from Ordnance. But whether or no, I'm going to take the sloop out while this breeze lasts to try her paces. We convey 12 merchantmen to Cagliari, sailing this evening if they're all here, and we must know how she handles." "Yes, Mr. Pullings, sir. Master's mate. Burford's longboat, the side with a draught."
"A draught for us? How many?"
18, sir." "And rum-looking cullies some of them are," he would have added if he'd dared.
"Do you know anything about them, Mr. Dillon?" asked Jack.
"I knew the Burford had a good many of the Charlotte's people and some from the receiving ships as drafts for Mahon, sir, but I never heard of any being meant for the Sophie." Jack was on the point of saying, "And there I was worrying about being stripped bare," but he contented himself with chuckling and wondering why this cornucopia should have poured itself out on him. "Lady Warren," came the reply in a flash of revelation. He laughed again and said, "Now I'm going across to the wharf, Mr. Dillon. Mr. Head is a business-like man, and he'll tell me whether the guns are to be had or not within 30 minutes. If they are, I will break out my handkerchief and you can start carrying out the warps directly. What now, Mr. Richards?"
"Sir," said the pale clerk, "Mr. Percy says I should bring you the receipts and letters to sign this time every day, and the fair copied book to read."
"Quite right," said Jack mildly. "Every ordinary day. Presently you will learn which is ordinary and which is not." He glanced at his watch. "Here are the receipts for the men. Show me the rest another time." The scene on deck was not unlike Cheapside with roadwork going on. Two parties under the carpenter and his crew were making ready the places for the hypothetical bow and stern chasers, and parcels of assorted landmen and boobies stood about with their baggage, some watching the work with an interested air, offering comments, others gaping vacantly about, gazing into the sky as though they'd never seen it before. One or two had even edged onto the holy quarter-deck.
"What in God's name is this infernal confusion?" cried Jack. "Mr. Watt, this is a king's ship, not the Margate Hoy. You, sir, get away forward."
For a moment, until his unaffected blaze of indignation galvanized them into activity, the Sophie's warrant officers gazed at him sadly. He caught the words, "all these people."
"I'm going ashore," he went on. "By the time I come back, this deck will present a very different appearance."
He was still red in the face as he went down into the boat after the midshipman. "Do they really imagine I shall leave an able-bodied man on shore if I can cram him aboard?" he said to himself. "Of course, their precious 3 watches will have to go. And even so, 14 inches will be hard to find." The 3-watch system was a humane arrangement that allowed the men to sleep a whole night through from time to time, whereas with 2 watches, 4 hours was the most they could ever hope for. But on the other hand, it did mean that half the men had the whole of the available space to sling their hammocks, since the other half was on deck. 18 and 6 is 24, said Jack, "and 50 or thereabouts, say 75. And of those, how many shall I watch?" He worked out this figure in order to multiply it by 14. For 14 inches was the space the regulations allowed for each hammock. And it seemed to him very doubtful whether the Sophie possessed anything like that amount of room, whatever her official complement might be.
He was still working at it when the midshipman called, "Unrow! Boat your oars!" And they kissed gently against the wharf. "Go back to the ship now, Mr. Ricketts," said Jack on an impulse. "I don't suppose I shall be long, and it may save a few minutes." But with the Burford's draught, he'd missed his chance. Other captains were there before him now, and he had to wait his turn. He walked up and down in the brilliant morning sun with one whose epaulette matched his own, Middleton, whose greater pull had enabled him to snap up the command of the Vertueuse, the charming French privateer that would have been Jack's, had there been any justice in the world. When they had exchanged the naval gossip of the Mediterranean, Jack remarked that he had come for a couple of 12-pounders. "Do you think she'll bear them?" asked Middleton.
"I hope so. Your 4-pound is a pitiful thing, though I must confess I feel anxious for her knees."
"Well, I hope so too," said Middleton, shaking his head. "At all events, you've come on the right day. It seems that Head is to be placed under Brown, and he's taken such a spite at it that he's selling off his stock like a fishwife at the end of the fair." Jack had already heard something of this development in the long, long squabble between the Ordnance Board and the Navy Board, and he longed to hear more. But at this moment Captain Halliwell came out, smiling all over his face, and Middleton, who had some faint remains of conscience, said, "You take my turn. I shall be in age with all my carronades to explain."
"Good morning, sir," said Jack. "I'm Aubrey of the Sophie, and I should like to try a couple of long 12s, if you please." With no change in his melancholy expression, Mr. Head said, "You know what they weigh?"
"Something in the nature of 3,300 weight, I believe."
3,300 weight, 3 pounds, 3 ounces, 3 pennyweight. Have a dozen, Captain, if you feel she'll bear them."
"Thank you. 2 will be plenty," said Jack, looking sharply to see whether he were being made game of.
"They're yours, then, and upon your own head be it," said Mr. Head with a sigh, making secret marks upon a worn, curling parchment slip. "Give it to the Master Parker, and he'll troll you out as pretty a pair as ever the heart of man could desire. I have some neat mortars, if you have room."
"I'm extremely obliged to you, Mr. Head," said Jack, laughing with pleasure. "I wish the rest of the service were run so."
"So do I, Captain, so do I," cried Mr. Head, his face growing suddenly dark with passion. "There are some slack-ass, bloody-minded men, flute-playing, fiddle-scraping, present-seeking, tail-bearing, double-poxed hounds that would keep you waiting about for a month, but I'm not one of them. Captain Middleton, sir, carronades for you, I presume." In the sunlight once more, Jack threw out his signal, and, peering among the masts and criss-crossed yards, he saw a figure at the Sophie's masthead bend as though to hail the deck, before disappearing down a backstay like a bead sliding upon a thread. Expedition was Mr. Head's watchword, but the Master Parker of the Ordnance Wharf didn't seem to have heard of it. He showed Jack the 2 12-pounders with great goodwill. "As pretty a pair as the heart of man could desire," he said, stroking their cascabels as Jack signed for them. But after that his mood seemed to change. There were several other captains in front of Jack. Fair was fair, turn and turn about. Then 36s were all in the way and would have to be moved first. He was precious short of hands. The Sophie had warped in long ago, and she was lying neatly against the dock, right under the derricks. There was more noise aboard her than there had been, more noise than was right, even with the relaxed harbour discipline, and he was sure some of the men had managed to get drunk already. Expectant faces, a good deal less expectant now, looked over her side at her captain as he paced up and down, glancing now at his watch and now at the sky. "By God!" he cried, clapping his hand to his forehead. "What a damn fool! I clean forgot the oil!" Turning short in his stride, he hurried over to the shed,
where a violent squealing showed that the Master Parker and his mates were trundling the slides of Middleton's carronades towards the neat line of their barrels. "Master Parker," called Jack, "come and look at my 12-pounders. I've been in such a hurry all morning that I do believe I forgot to anoint them." With these words, he privately laid down a gold piece upon each touch-hole, and a slow look of approval appeared on the Parker's face. "If my gunner hadn't been sick, he would have reminded me," added Jack. "Well, thank ye, sir. It always has been the custom, and I don't like to see the old ways die, I do confess," said the Parker with some still unevaporated surliness. But then, brightening progressively, he said, "A hurry, you mentioned, Captain. I'll see what we can do." 5 minutes later, the bow chaser, neatly slung by its train loops, side loops, pommelion and muzzle, floated gently over the Sophie's forecastle within half an inch of its ideal resting place. Jack and the carpenter were on all fours side by side, rather as though they were playing bears, and they were listening for the sound her beams and timbers would make as the strain came off the derrick. Jack beckoned with his hand, calling, "Handsomely, handsomely now." The Sophie was perfectly silent, all her people watching intently, even the tub party with their buckets poised, even the human chain who were tossing the 12-pound round shot from the shore to the side and so down to the gunner's mate in the shot locker. The gun touched, sat firm. There was a deep, not unhealthy, creaking, and the Sophie settled a little by the head. "Capital," said Jack, surveying the gun as it stood there, well within its chalked-out space. "Plenty of room all round, great oceans of room, upon my word," he said, backing a step. In his haste to avoid being trodden down, the gunner's mate behind him collided with his neighbour, who ran into his, setting off a chain reaction in that crowded, roughly triangular space between the foremast and the stem, that resulted in the maiming of one ship's boy, and very nearly in the watery death of another. "Where's the boatswain? Now, Mr. Watt, let me see the tackles rigged. You want a hard-eye becket on that block. Where's the breeching?" "Almost ready, sir," said the sweating, harassed boatswain. "I'm working the cunt splice myself." "Well," said Jack, hurrying off to where the stern chaser hung poised above the Sophie's quarter-deck, ready to plunge through her bottom if gravity could but have its way. "A simple thing like a cunt splice will not take a man-of-war's boatswain long, I believe. Set those men to work, Mr. Lamb, if you please. This is not Fiddler's Green." He looked at his watch again. "Mr. Mowat," he said, looking at a cheerful young master's mate. Mr. Mowat's cheerful look changed to one of extreme gravity. "Mr. Mowat, do you know Joselito's coffee-house?" "Yes, sir." "Then be so good as to go there and ask for Dr. Maturin. My compliments, and I am very much concerned to say we shall not be back in port by dinner-time, but I will send a boat this evening at any time he chooses to appoint." They were not back in port by dinner-time. It would indeed have been a logical impossibility, since they had not yet left it, but were sweeping majestically through the close-packed craft towards the fairway. One advantage of having a small vessel with a great many hands aboard is that you can execute manoeuvres denied to any ship of the line. And Jack preferred this arduous creeping to being towed, or to threading along under sail with a thoroughly uneasy crew, disturbed in all their settled habits and jostling full of strangers. In the open channel he had himself rowed round the Sophie. He considered her from every angle, and at the same time he weighed the advantages and disadvantages of sending all the women ashore. It would be easy to find most of them while the men were at their dinner, not merely the local girls who were there for fun and pocket money, but also the semi-permanent Judies. If he made one sweep now, then another just before their true departure might clear the sloop entirely. He wanted no women aboard. They only caused trouble. and with this fresh influx they would cause even more. On the other hand, there was a certain lack of zeal aboard, a lack of real spring, and he didn't mean to turn it into sullenness, particularly that afternoon. Sailors were as conservative as cats, as he knew very well. They would put up with incredible labour and hardship, to say nothing of danger, but it had to be what they were used to, or they would grow brutish. She was very low in the water, to be sure, a little by the head and listing a trifle to port. All that extra weight would have been far better below the waterline. But he'd have to see how she handled. "Shall I send the hands to dinner, sir?" asked James Dillon when Jack was aboard again. "No, Mr. Dillon, we must profit by this wind. Once we're past the Cape, they may go below. Those guns are breached and frapped." "Yes, sir." "Then we will make sail, in sweeps. All hands to make sail." The boatswain sprang his call and hurried away to the forecastle amidst a great rushing of feet and a good deal of bellowing. "Newcomers below! Silence there!" Another rush of feet. The Sophie's regular crew stood poised in their usual places in dead silence. A voice on board the Genereux, a cable's length away, could be heard quite clear and plain. "Sophie's making sail!" She lay there, rocking gently out in Mahon Harbour, with the shipping on her starboard beam and quarter and the brilliant town beyond it. The breeze, a little abaft her larboard beam, a northerly wind, was pushing her stern round a trifle. Jack paused, and as it came just so, he cried, "Away aloft!" The calls repeated the order, and instantly the shrouds were dark with passing men, racing up as though on their stairs at home. "Trice up! Lay out!" The calls again. And the top men hurried out on the yards. They cast off the gaskets, the lines that held the sails tight furled to the yards. They gathered the canvas under their arms and waited. "Let fall!" came the order. And with it, the howling peep, 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 from the boatswain and his mates. "Sheet home! Sheet home! Hoist away! Cheerly there in the foretop! Look alive! T'gansel sheets! Hands to the braces! Belay!" A gentle push from above heeled the Sophie over, then another and another, each more delightfully urgent, until it was one steady thrust. She was under way, and all along her side there sang a run of living water. Jack and his lieutenant exchanged a glance. It hadn't been bad. The foretop gallant sail had taken its time because of a misunderstanding as to how newcomers should be defined, and whether the six restored Sophies were to be considered in that injurious light, which had led to a furious, silent squabble on the yard. And the sheeting home had been rather spasmodic, but it had not been disgraceful, and they would not have to support the derision of the other men-of-war in the harbour. There had been moments in the confusion of the morning when each had dreaded just that thing. The Sophie had spread her wings a little more like an unhurried dove than an eager hawk, but not so much so that the expert eyes on shore would dwell upon her with disapprobation. And as for the mere landsmen, their eyes were so satiated with the coming and going of every kind of vessel that they passed over her departure with glassy indifference. "Forgive me, sir," said Stephen Maturin, touching his hat to a nautical gentleman on the quay, "but might I ask whether you know which is the ship called Sophia?" "A king's ship, sir?" asked the officer, returning his salute. "A man of war? There's no ship of that name. But perhaps you refer to the sloop, sir, the sloop Sophia?" "That may well be the case, sir. No man could easily surpass me in ignorance of naval terms. The vessel I have in mind is commanded by Captain Aubrey." "Just so, the sloop, the 14-gun sloop. She lies almost directly in front of you, sir, in a line with the little white house on the point." "The ship with triangular sails?" "No, that is a Polarca Settee, somewhere to the left and farther off." "The little, small, squat merchantman with two masts?" "Well," with a laugh, "she is a trifle low in the water, but she is a man of war, I assure you.
and I believe she's about to make sail. Yes, there go her topsails. Sheeted home, they hoist the yards. To gansels? What's amiss? Ah, there we are. Not very smartly done, but all's well that ends well, and the Sophie never was one of your very brisk performers. See, she gathers way. She'll fetch the mouth of the harbour on this wind without touching a brace. She's sailing away? Indeed she is. She must be running 3 knots already, maybe 4. I'm very much obliged to you, sir, said Stephen, lifting his hat. Servantshire, said the officer, lifting his. He looked after Stephen for a while. Should I ask him whether he's well? I've left it too late. However, he seems steady enough now. Stephen had walked down to the quay to find out whether the Sophie could be reached on foot, or whether he should have to take a boat to keep his dinner engagement, for his conversation with Mr. Florey had persuaded him that not only was the engagement intended to be kept, but that the more general invitation was equally serious. An eminently practicable suggestion, most certainly to be acted upon. How civil, how more than civil, Florey had been. Had explained the medical service of the Royal Navy, and taken him to see Mr. Edwards of the Centaur perform quite an interesting amputation. Stephen had allowed his mind to convince itself entirely, and the strength of his emotion at the sight of the Sophie, her white sails and her low hull dwindling fast over the shining sea, showed him how much he had come to look forward to the prospect of a new place and new skies, a living, and a closer acquaintance with this friend who was now running fast towards the quarantine island, behind which he would presently vanish. He walked up through the town with his mind in a curious state. He had suffered so many disappointments recently that it didn't seem possible he could bear another. What was more, he had allowed all his defences to disperse, unarmed. It was while he was reassembling them and calling out his reserves that his feet carried him past Joselito's coffee house, and voices said, "There he is! Call out, run after him, you'll catch him if you run." He hadn't been into the coffee house that morning because it was a question either of paying for a cup of coffee or of paying for a boat to row him out to the Sophie, and he had therefore been unavailable for the midshipman who now came running along behind him. "Dr. Maturin?" asked young Mowat, and stopped short, quite shocked by the pale glare of reptilian dislike. However, he delivered his message, and he was relieved to find that it was greeted with a far more human look. "Most kind," said Stephen. "What do you imagine would be a convenient time, sir?" "Oh, I suppose about 6 o'clock, sir," said Mowat. "Then at 6 o'clock I shall be at the Crown Steps," said Stephen. "I am very much obliged to you, sir, for your diligence in finding me out." They parted with a bow apiece, and Stephen said privately, "I shall go across to the hospital and offer Mr. Florey my assistance. He has a compound fracture above the elbow that will call for primary resection of the joint. It is a great while since I felt the grind of bone under my saw," he added, smiling with anticipation. Cape Mola lay on their larboard quarter. The troubled blasts and calms caused by the heights and valleys along the great harbour's winding northern shore no longer buffeted them, and with an almost steady tramontana at north by east, the Sophie was running fast towards Italy under her courses, single-reefed topsails and topgallants. "Bring her up as close as she'll lie," said Jack. "How near will she point, Mr. Marshall? 6?
"I doubt she'll do as well as 6, sir," said the master, shaking his head.
She's a little sullen today with the extra weight forward.
Jack took the wheel, and as he did so, a last gust from the island staggered the sloop, sending white water along her lee rail, plucking Jack's hat from his head and streaming his bright yellow hair away to the south-southwest. The master leapt after the hat, snatched it from the seaman who had rescued it in the hammock netting, and solicitously wiping the cockade with his handkerchief, he stood by Jack's side, holding it with both hands.
"Old Sodom and Gomorrah's sweet on Goldilocks," murmured John Lane, foretopman, to his friend Thomas Gross.
Thomas winked his eye and jerked his head, but without any appearance of censure. They were concerned with the phenomenon, not with any moral judgment.
"Well, I hope he don't take it out of us too much, that's all, mate," he replied.
Jack let her pay off until the flurry was over, and then, as he began to bring her back, his hands strong on the spokes, so he came into direct contact with the living essence of the sloop. The vibration beneath his palm, something between a sound and a flow, came straight up from her rudder, and it joined with the innumerable rhythms, the creak and humming of her hull and rigging. The keen, clear wind swept in on his left cheek, and as he bore on the helm, so the Sophie answered, quicker and more nervous than he'd expected. Closer and closer to the wind. They were all staring up and forward. At last, in spite of the fiddle-tight bowline, the foretop gallant sail shivered, and Jack eased off. "East by north, a half north," he observed with satisfaction. "Keep her so," he said to the timoneer, and gave the order, the long-expected and very welcome order, to pipe to dinner. Dinner, while the Sophie as close-hauled on the larboard tack as she could be, made her offing into the lonely water, where 12-pound cannonballs could do no harm and where disaster could pass unnoticed. The miles streamed out behind her, her white path stretching straight and true a little south of west. Jack looked at it from his stern window with approval. Remarkably little leeway, and a good steady hand must be steering to keep that furrow so perfect in the sea. He was dining in solitary state, a Spartan meal of sodden kid and cabbage mixed, and it was only when he realised that there was no one to whom he could impart the innumerable observations that came bubbling into his mind that he remembered. This was his first formal meal as a captain. He almost made a jocose remark about it to his steward, for he was in very high spirits too, but he checked himself. It would not do. "I shall grow used to it in time," he said, and looked again with loving relish at the sea. The guns were not a success. Even with only half a cartridge, the bow chaser recoiled so strongly that at the third discharge the carpenter came running up on deck, so pale and perturbed that all discipline went by the board.
"Don't he do it, sir?" he cried, covering the touch-hole with his hand. "If you could but see her poor knees, and the spirketing starting in five separate places, oh dear, oh dear!"
The poor man hurried to the ring-bolts of the breeching.
"There, I knew it! My clench is half-drawn in this poor thin old stuff! Why didn't you tell me, Tom?"
he cried, gazing reproachfully at his mate.
"I dursn't," said Tom, hanging his head.
"It won't do, sir," said the carpenter. "Not with these here timbers, it won't. Not with this here deck."
Jack felt his collar rising. It was a ludicrous situation on the overcrowded forecastle, with the carpenter crawling about at his feet in apparent supplication, peering at the seams. And this was no sort of way to address a captain. But there was no resisting Mr. Lamb's total sincerity, particularly as Jack secretly agreed with him. The force of the recoil, all that weight of metal darting back and being brought up with a twang by the breeching, was too much, far too much for the Sophie. Furthermore, there really wasn't room to work the ship with the 2 12-pounders and their tackle filling so much of what little space there was.
but he was bitterly disappointed. A 12-pound ball could pierce at 500 yards. It could send up a shower of lethal splinters, carry away a yard, do great execution. He tossed one up and down in his hand, considering. Whereas, at any range, a 4-pounder... "'And was you to fire off t'other one?' said Mr. Lamb, with desperate courage, still on his hands and knees. "'Your visitor wouldn't have a dry stitch on him, for the seams have opened something cruel.' William Jevons, carpenter's crew, came up and whispered, "'Foot of water in the well,' in a rumble that could have been heard at the masthead. The carpenter stood up, put on his hat, touched it, and reported, "'There's a foot of water in the well, sir.' "'Very well, Mr. Lamb,' said Jack placidly. "'We'll pump it out again.' "'Mr. Day,' he said, turning to the gunner, who had crawled up on deck for the firing of the 12-pounders, would have crept out of his grave had he been in it. "'Mr. Day, draw and house the guns, if you please. "'And, bosun, man the chain-pump.' He patted the warm barrel of the 12-pounder regretfully and walked aft. He wasn't particularly worried about the water. The Sophie had been capering about in a lively way with the short sea coming across, and she would have made a good deal by her natural working. But he was vexed about the chasers, profoundly vexed. And he looked with even greater malignance at the main yard. "'We shall have to get the t'gallants off her presently, Mr. Dillon,' he observed, picking up the traverse board. He consulted it more as a matter of form than anything else, for he knew very well where they were. With some sense that develops in true seamen, he was aware of the loom of the land, a dark presence beyond the horizon behind him, behind his right shoulder blade. They had been beating steadily up into the wind, and the pegs showed almost equal boards, east-northeast followed by west-northwest. They had tacked 5 times. Sophie was not as quick in stays as he could have wished, and worn once. And they had been running at 7 knots. These calculations ran their course in his mind, and as soon as he looked for it, the answer was ready. "'Keep on this course for 30 minutes, and then put her almost before the wind, 2 points off. That'll bring you home.' "'It would be as well to shorten sail now,' he observed. "'We will hold our course for 30 minutes.' With this he went below, meaning to do something in the way of dealing with the great mass of papers that called for attention. Apart from such things as the statements of stores and the pay-books, there was the Sophie's log, which would tell him something of the past history of the vessel, and her muster-book, which would do the same for her company. He leafed through the pages. Sunday, September the 22nd, 1799, winds northwest, west, south, course north 40 west, distance 49 miles, latitude 37 degrees 59 north, longitude 9 degrees 38 west, Cape St. Vincent south 27 east 64 miles. PM. Fresh breezes and squally with rain, made and shortened sail occasionally. AM. Hard gales, and forehanded the square mainsail. At 6 saw a strange sail to the southward. At 8, more moderate, reefed the square mainsail and set it. At 9, spoke her. She was a Swedish brig bound to Barcelona in ballast. At noon, weather calm, head round the compass. Dozens of entries of that kind of duty. And of convoy work. The plain, unspectacular, everyday sort of employment that made up 90% of a service life. Or more. People variously employed, read the articles of war. Convoy in company, into gallant sails and second reef topsails. At 6, made private signal to 2 line of battleships which answered. All sails set. The people employed working up junk. Light airs inclinable to calm, scrubbed hammocks. Mustered by divisions, read articles of war, and punished Joseph Wood, John Lakey, Matthew Johnson, and William Musgrave with 12 lashes for drunkenness. PM, calm and hazy weather at 5, Out sweeps and boats to pull offshore at 6:30. Came to with the stream anchor Cape Molar, south 6 west, distance 5 leagues. At 8:30, coming on to blow suddenly, was obliged to cut the hawser and make sail. Read the articles of war, and performed divine service. Punished George Sennett with 24 lashes for contempt. Francis Spechel, Robert Wilkinson, and Joseph Wood for drunkenness. A good many entries of that kind. A fair amount of flogging, but nothing heavy. None of your 100-lash sentences. It contradicted his first impression of laxity. He would have to look into it more thoroughly. Then, the muster. George Williams, ordinary seaman, born Bengal, volunteered at Lisbon, 24th of August, 1797, ran 27th of March, 1798, Lisbon. Fortunato Cornelia, midshipman, 21, born Genoa, discharged 1st of June, 1797, per order Rear Admiral Nelson, per ticket. Samuel Wilsey, able seaman, born Long Island, volunteered Porto, 10th of October, 1797, ran 8th of February, 1799, at Lisbon from the boat. Patrick Wade, landman, 21, born County Fermanagh, pressed 20th of November, 1796, at Porto Ferrau, discharged 11th of November, 1799, to Bulldog, per order Captain Darley. Richard Sutton, lieutenant, joined 31st of December, 1796, per order Commodore Nelson, discharged dead 2nd of February, 1798, killed in action with a French privateer. Richard William Baldick, lieutenant, joined 28th of February 1798 per commission from Earl St. Vincent, discharged 18th of April 1800 to join Pallas per order Lord Keith. In the column Dead Man's Clothes there was the sum of £8.10 and 6 pence against his name. Clearly poor Sutton's kit auctioned at the mainmast. But Jack couldn't keep his mind to the stiff-ruled column. The brilliant sea, darker blue than the sky, and the white wake across it kept drawing his eyes to the stern window. In the end, he closed the book and indulged himself in the luxury of staring out. If he chose, he could go to sleep, he reflected. And he looked around, relishing this splendid privacy, the rarest of commodities at sea. As a lieutenant in the Leander and other fair-sized ships, he had been able to look out of the wardroom windows, of course, but never alone, never unaccompanied by human presence and activity. It was wonderful. But it so happened that just now he longed for human presence and activity. His mind was too eager and restless to savour the full charm of solitude, although he knew it was there. And as soon as the ting-ting, ting-ting of 4 bells sounded, he was up on deck. Dillon and the master were standing by the starboard brass 4-pounder, and they were obviously discussing some part of her rigging visible from that point. As soon as he appeared, they moved over to the larboard side in the traditional way, leaving him his privileged area of the quarter-deck. This was the first time it had happened to him. He hadn't expected it, hadn't thought of it, and it gave him a ridiculous thrill of pleasure. But it also deprived him of a companion, unless he were to call James Dillon over. He took 2 or 3 turns, looking up at the yards. They were braced as sharp as the main and foremast shrouds would allow, but they were not as sharp as they might have been in an ideal world, and he made a mental note to tell the bosun to set up cross cat harpings. They might gain 3 or 4 degrees. "Mr. Dillon," he said, "be so good as to bear up and set the square mainsail. South by west to half south."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Double reefed, sir."
"No, Mr. Dillon, no reef," said Jack with a smile. And he resumed his pacing.
There were orders all round him, the trample of feet, the bosun's calls. His eyes took in the whole of the operation with a curious detachment. Curious, because his heart was beating high. The Sophie paid off smoothly. "Thus,"
Thus, cried the master at the con, and the helmsman steadied her. As she was coming round before the wind, the fore-and-aft mainsail vanished in billowing clouds that quickly subsided into the members of a long sailcloth parcel, greyish, inanimate. And immediately afterwards the square mainsail appeared, ballooning and fluttering for a few seconds, and then masted, disciplined and squared, with its sheets hauled aft. The Sophie shot forward, and by the time Dillon called belay, she had increased her speed by at least 2 knots, plunging her head and raising her stern as though she were surprised at her rider. As well she might have been. Dillon sent another man to the wheel in case a fault in the wind should broach her too. The square mainsail was as taut as a drum. "Pass the word for the sailmaker," said Jack. "Mr. Henry, could you get me another cloth onto that sail, was you to take a deep goring leech?"
"No, sir," said the sailmaker positively. "Not if it was ever so. Not with that yard, sir.
Look at all the horrible bump there is now, more like what you might call a hog's bladder, properly speaking."
Jack went to the rail and looked sharply at the sea running by, the long curve as it rose after the hollow under the lee bow. He grunted and returned to his staring at the mainyard, a piece of wood rather more than 30 feet long, and tapering from some 7 inches in the slings, the middle part, to 3 at the yardarms, the extremities.
"More like a crojack than a mainyard," he thought, for the 20th time since he first set eyes upon it. He watched the yard intently as the force of the wind worked upon it. The Sophie was running no faster now, and so there was no longer any easing of the load. The yard plied, and it seemed to Jack that he heard it groan. The Sophie's braces led forward, of course, she being a brig, and the plying was greatest at the yardarms, which irked him. But there was some degree of bowing all along. He stood there with his hands behind his back, his eyes set upon it. And the other officers on the quarter-deck, Dillon, Marshall, Pullings, and young Ricketts, stood attentively, not speaking, looking sometimes at their new captain, and sometimes at the sail. They were not the only men to wonder, for most of the more experienced hands on the forecastle had joined in this double scrutiny. A gaze up, then a sidelong stare at Jack. It was a strange atmosphere. Now that they were before the wind, or very nearly, that is to say, now that they were going in the same direction as the wind, nearly all the song had gone out of the rigging. The Sophie's long, slow pitching, no cross-sea to move her quickly, made little noise. And added to this, there was the strained quietness of men murmuring together not to be heard. But in spite of their care, a voice drifted back to the quarter-deck. "He'll carry all away if he cracks on so." Jack didn't hear it. He was quite unconscious of the tension around him, far away in his calculations of the opposing forces. Not mathematical calculations by any means, but rather sympathetic. The calculations of a rider with a new horse between his knees and a dark hedge coming. Presently, he went below. And after he'd stared out of the stern window for some time, he looked at the chart. Cape Molo would be on their starboard now. They should raise it very soon. And it would add a little greater thrust to the wind by deflecting it along the coast. Very quietly he whistled De Vieni, reflecting, "If I make a success of this, and if I make a mint of money, several hundred guineas, say, the first thing I shall do after paying off is to go to Vienna to the opera." James Dillon knocked on the door.
"The wind is increasing, sir," he said. "May I hand the mainsail, or reef, at least?"
"No, no, Mr. Dillon, no," said Jack, smiling. Then, reflecting that it was scarcely fair to leave this on his lieutenant's shoulders, he added, "I shall come on deck in 2 minutes." In fact, he was there in less than one, just in time to hear the ominous, rending crack. "Up sheets!" he cried.
Hands to the jeers. Topsails, clue lines, clap under the lifts, lower away cheerily. Look alive there.
They looked alive. The yard was small. Soon it was on deck, the sail unbent, the yard stripped, and everything coiled down.
Hopelessly sprung in the sling, sir, said the carpenter sadly. He was having a wretched day of it. I could try to fish it, but it would never be answerable, like.
Jack nodded without any particular expression. He walked across to the rail, put a foot onto it, and hoisted himself up into the first ratlins. The Sophie rose on the swell, and there indeed lay Cape Mola, a dark bar 3 points on the starboard beam.
"I think we must touch up the lookout," he observed. "Lay her for the harbour, Mr. Dillon, if you please. Boom, mainsail, and everything she can carry. There's not a minute to lose."
45 minutes later, the Sophie picked up her moorings. And before the way was off her, the cutter splashed into the water. The sprung yard was already afloat, and the boat set off urgently in the direction of the wharf, towing the yard behind like a streaming tail.
"Well, there's the fleet's own smiling serpent," remarked Bowor as Jack ran up the steps. "Brings the poor old Sophie in, first time he ever set foot on her, with barely a yard standing at all, her timbers all crazy, and half the ship's company pumping for dear life, and every man on deck the livelong day, dear knows, with never a pause for the smell of a pipe. And he runs him up old steps, smiling like King George was at the top there to knight him.
And short time for dinner, as will never be made up," said a low voice in the middle of the boat.
"Silence!" cried Mr. Babington, with as much outrage as he could manage.
"Mr. Brown," said Jack, with an earnest look, "you can do me a very essential service, if you will. I've sprung my mainyard hopelessly. I'm concerned to tell you, and yet I must sail this evening. The Fanny is in. So I beg you to condemn it and issue me another in its place. Nay, never look so shocked, my dear sir," he said, taking Mr. Brown's arm and leading him towards the cutter. "I'm bringing you back the 12-pounders, ordnance being now within your purview, as I understand, because I feared the sloop might be overburthened."
"With all my heart," said Mr. Brown, looking at the awful chasm in the yard, held up mutely for his inspection by the cutter's crew.
"But there's not another spar in the yard small enough for you. Come, sir, you're forgetting the Genereux. She had 3 spare fore-to-gallant yards, as well as a vast mound of other spares, and you would be the first to admit that I have a moral right to one."
"Well, you may try it if you wish. You may sway it up to let us see what it looks like, but I make no promise."
"Let my men take it out, sir. I remember just where they're stowed. Mr. Babington, 4 men. Come along now, look alive."
"'Tis only on trial, remember, Captain Aubrey," called Mr. Brown. "I'll watch you sway it up."
"Now that's what I call a real spar," said Mr. Lamb, peering lovingly over the side at the yard. "Never a knot, never a curl. A French spar, I dare say, 43 foot, as clean as a whistle. You'll spread a mainsail as a mainsail on that, sir."
"Yes, yes," said Jack impatiently.
"Is that hawser brought to the capstan yet?"
"Hawser to, sir,"
came the reply after a moment's pause.
"Then heave away."
The hawser had been made fast to the middle of the yard, and then laid along it almost to its starboard extremity, being tied in half a dozen places from the slings to the yardarm with stoppers, bands of spun yarn. The hawser ran from the yardarm up to the top block at the masthead, and so down through another block on deck, and thence to the capstan. So as the capstan turned, the yard rose from the water, sloping more and more nearly to the vertical, until it came aboard quite upright, steered carefully end on through the rigging.
"Cut the outer stopper," said Jack.
The spun yarn dropped and the yard canted a little, held by the next. As it rose, so the other stoppers were out, and when the last went, the yard swung square neatly under the top.
"It'll never do, Captain Aubrey,"
called Mr. Brown, hailing over the quiet evening air through his trumpet. "It's far too large. It'll certainly carry away. You must saw off the yard arms and half the third quarter."